On this episode of Skeptico.
The end result of all those experiments is just that this is real, this really happened. Because as soon as we get past that, we have all these, you know, how many angels fit on the head of a pin questions, right? So you can use traditional science, materialistic science, and you can use it really well to say whether or not this is observable inside of our shared conscious experience that we have. But once you get beyond that, is it really possible to say much that is at all meaningful beyond that?
To a certain degree, yes, because what science does and should do is collect evidence. For my part, I always have the feeling there's a very large imbalance, especially in frontier areas of science, between what we can observe and what people expect to make out of these observations. Like, sometimes they go, okay, perhaps you out-of-body experiences, veridical observations from out-of-body experiences, perhaps they are real, but we don't have a theory, so it can't be real. So they put too much emphasis on having a theory or not having a theory. But for me, that's not the right approach.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we talk about terminal lucidity, a very interesting topic related to near-death experience science, an underexplored and under-researched topic, and that's a situation that we hope to remedy a little bit by shedding a light on this interesting area with our guest, Dr. Michael Nam. Dr. Nam is extremely well-respected in this field, having worked with Dr. Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia and published several noteworthy papers. He's also a guy who has some interesting thoughts on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which we get into, and the future of near-death experience science, something I've been talking a lot about and am going to talk a lot about in the future. I have a lot of respect for Dr. Nam. He's got some really interesting ideas, and it was a great pleasure talking with him. Here's my dialogue with Dr. Michael Nam. Today we welcome Dr. Michael Nam to Skeptico. Dr. Nam is the author of numerous scholarly papers on terminal lucidity, parapsychology, and near-death experience-related science, and he has a really interesting way of rolling that all into his background, which is biology. He's a real biologist and has done a lot of that work, too. He's a former colleague of Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, and he's very well-known and well-respected in these fields. Dr. Nam, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks again, Alex, for your invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. My first time out there.
Well, it shouldn't be. You know, in searching you on Google, there's a mix of a lot of German references because you are German and you have published a lot of your work in German, but there's not enough on the English side, and there's not enough references to really some great work that you've done, and I hope we can bring more people into your world and your interesting take on the broader issues of near-death experience science, because that's what really intrigues me, is you kind of take it, you just kind of pull back the lens a little bit in some really useful ways, starting with this whole thing of terminal lucidity. So let's jump right into the topics that we want to talk about. Let's talk about terminal lucidity, what it is, and then first of all, and then why you think we need to understand it within the context of NDE-related phenomena.
Well, first, I refer to terminal lucidity as the unexpected return of mental clarity, perhaps even of memory, shortly before somebody dies. And this refers to actually any kind of person who dies. But in my papers, or in the papers I've co-authored with Bruce and other people, we focused specifically on people who died and who had some neurologic or psychiatric disorder many years before they came to the point of dying, because I think in that cases, the terminal lucidity is most interesting, because you really end up asking yourself, why are those people clear again if they hadn't been clear since maybe years before? And so this raises, of course, some important questions regarding the nature of consciousness, its relation to the brain and the brain functioning, brain biochemistry, and all these things.
So in the papers that you've authored, you have some really intriguing case studies, and you've done quite a thorough job of scanning the literature, looking for these case studies, and interviewing folks and getting new case information as well. But, I mean, the classic one, and one of the ones that I really enjoyed, is, you know, someone who's suffered Alzheimer's for a long period of time is more or less completely disabled. This woman, the woman I remember, is this is a case in Iceland, and she's lying in bed, and all of a sudden she sits up and clear as day, looks at her son and recites this really beautiful poem and recites it perfectly, and then boom, falls back into this state of whatever that locked up state is that severe Alzheimer's sufferers have, where she really can't do anything. So tell us a little bit about like that case or another case that just really befuddles the complete idea that we have about how the brain works in these really hampered situations like Alzheimer's.
Yes, I perfectly agree that that's one of the most intriguing cases. And it relates to an Alzheimer's person with a long-time Alzheimer's disease history. And in fact, we have collected quite a number of these cases. It seems that the Alzheimer cases are somehow very prominent in our case collection. And they are particularly interesting because the Alzheimer disease destroys the brain to a very great extent. So that in the end, in the terminal stage of this disease, people usually are non-responsive. They cannot do anything. They don't talk. They just lie in their bed. And this case was also one of this category. It actually was related to me by Erlendur Haraldsson, whom you may know from his many publications also on near-death related issues. So yeah, he related that to me. So I cannot tell you many more about it. But we have many other cases in which people suddenly seem to surprise their bystanders by addressing them personally while they didn't know or recognize them for years before, who suddenly sat up or seemed to have access to their memory and talked about their lives, talked about their problems they had with, let's say, the church or their fear of death and all these things. And then they just leaned back and seem to die very soon after this episode, where everybody thinks, wow, she's recovering or he's recovering and he's coming back to life. But quite the contrary, this person is very often in such cases about to die. And many nurses and caretakers have actually confirmed that they know this phenomenon, that if a person who has been absent for a very long time suddenly becomes clear, they already get alert and think, oh, wow, this person is actually going to die.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I was going to ask you, but maybe I was going to ask you what some of your colleagues who are kind of more skeptical of the entire near-death experience science field have to say about terminal lucidity. But maybe in asking that, I'd also ask, you know, why more people aren't open to just what these end-of-life care providers tell us? Because as you said, it's been my experience that when you talk to these people, it's just standard stuff. They're like, oh, yeah, I see that all the time. That's what that means. You know, the person encountering spirit, out-of-body spirit encounters by, you know, their loved ones and stuff like that. Oh, yeah, happens all the time around here. I mean, why isn't anyone talking to these people? They seem to have a wealth of information about this, but I don't think your colleagues probably have been so receptive to the idea of terminal lucidity. What do they say?
Well, let's say that the typical physician or the typical neuroscientists they will say, well, we know that phenomenon. It's one of these lucid intervals that every person has with a neurological disease or the psychiatric disease. Every now and then they become lucid. And sometimes it just happens that around the same time they also die. So that's they just regard it as an accident. So there's nothing really interesting about that. It's just one of these things. But I agree that the persons who actually work with the dying, they have often a very different point of view, because these lucid intervals are so strikingly different from other lucid intervals they might have had some years before. And I think one reason why the physicians don't engage in too much dialogues with the practitioners, is because they also, the practitioners or those who care for the dying, they are perhaps somehow afraid to relate that to the science authorities or to the boss of the hospital. I think that if you talk to these people, sometimes this comes through. They experience it a lot, but they don't have real a background or a social background or colleagues with whom they could talk and share their experience. Sometimes they also like to do it more privately, and they don't go public with that because it might be that they will face some problems.
Right. That kind of talk is just totally not sanctioned. And I have to add, you know, my father was a longtime Alzheimer's sufferer before he passed away, and he passed away due to complications related to Alzheimer's. I have to tell you, from my experience, and I think in seeing other people who suffered similarly, there might be some of these brief moments of lucidity that do come along in the later stages of Alzheimer's, but nothing like what you're reporting. I mean, the lucidity, I think, that people will say they see in Alzheimer's patients is, you know, one day they will remember for a few seconds who you are, or they will remember a memory. But the kind of lucidity, moments of lucidity that you report in these cases are so dramatic, you know. I just don't believe that I've ever seen or heard about anything like that in a situation other than these kind of extreme terminal lucidity things. With that, let me kind of shift the focus a little bit, because one of the things that you've done, and it may seem obvious to some people, but it certainly hasn't been as pronounced in the literature and in the science as you've made it, is you've made the step and said, okay, we need to understand and think about terminal lucidity in terms of its relationship to this dying process and all the strangeness that we see around the dying process, including near-death experience, including mediumship, including all these other things that, if we really step back, there seems to be some kind of weird thing going on with the dying process. Tell us a little bit about how you go about trying to piece that together.
Well, good question, because it's such a multifaceted area of potential research that one could address in these in the near-death states. Well, first of all, I think that terminal lucidity needs to be lifted beyond the present stage, it consists mainly of anecdotes. So one focus of my papers is to get to ventilate the idea of terminal lucidity and to get researchers look at it and perform studies. Like, you can perform studies into terminal lucidity or into lucid intervals. In for example, you document lucid intervals. How do they occur? What's the depth? What's the clarity? You could develop scales to assess the depth or the degree of memory recovery and all these things, and put that on a time scale throughout the years that a person is suffering from a particular disease. And there are scales like this which are applied in also in Alzheimer's disease research, also like we have the near-death experience, the scale of Bruce Grayson. One could adopt these types of scales or research to terminal lucidity to foster the research into that phenomena so that it leaves a little bit the and purely anecdotal level. And I think so far this has not been the case.
So that's, let me just double check that I understand that, because it's kind of intriguing. So you're I think suggesting that just like the what's used to be called the Grayson scale is now called, I think, just the NDE scale, which measures the depth and some associated factors related to a near-death experience. Just as that's become somewhat of a standard used by many near-death experience researchers and a way to kind of compare research among different researchers in different places, you're suggesting that you could do the same thing with terminal lucidity. And it sounds like you're even saying that it might be even a little bit easier now because we're already tracking some of this kind of behavior already with Alzheimer's patients because we're interested in hearing what they are experiencing, and these moments of lucidity are interesting to us anyway. So just an extension of that, we could kind of gather some interesting data around this dying process.
Yes, I think so. And also not only around this dying process, but also before, during the development of the disease. For example, there are scales that assess the daily fluctuations of mental clarity in, let's say, Alzheimer's persons. Or there are scales that are already applied in the medical context that address the capability of a patient. What can he do? What is he not anymore able to do? And all these things. And one could just modify these already existing scales and adopt their use to documenting the development of lucid intervals and also, of course, terminal lucidity. And I think if you would do that, then you could nicely see in the end, well, that's my hypothesis, that the terminal lucidity is quite different from what we talked about earlier, the earlier intervals of lucidity, so that we could compile a real data set that highlights the speciality of this moment, so that the typical standard answer, well, it's just one of these typical lucid intervals and it only happens to occur around the time somebody dies, that can be countered if that documentation would be successful. But I think it could be. People could do that. But of course, first they need to know about all this, and this is what I try to reach with publicizing that issue of terminal lucidity.
Right. That's excellent. And certainly
and one more point, of course, a little point, but perhaps one could even find some new ways of therapies. I think that's also an interesting thing to think about, because if the memory or the personality of an Alzheimer patient is still somewhere hidden behind this usual behavior or non-behavior, then perhaps we could find ways to elicit lucid intervals already earlier, or to help the patient get a better access to memories, to communication, and not wait until, let's say, the last few minutes before death or so.
Yeah, way to toss a bone to the traditional materialist and traditional neuroscientists. So yeah, that's great. So in addition to the work you've done on terminal lucidity, if someone goes to your website, which we have linked up in the show notes here, they're going to find a bunch of other really interesting work that you've published and you've explored, because you seem to be just this kind of inquisitive guy whose mind and background takes you in a number of places. And one of those that I wanted to talk about today was the very interesting article you sent me on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I think what you explore in that is how maybe we sometimes misuse and misunderstand what that document really is and what it really means. So I was hoping we could spend a few minutes talking about the Tibetan Book of the Dead and what you discovered.
Yes, of course. Yeah, basically, what you've said already sketches nicely what I wanted to say with this paper, because, let's put it this way, I became motivated to write about the Tibetan Book of the Dead because of personal experiences I had with adherents of the Tibetan traditions. And when I talked about near-death experiences, what the people experience, typical stages of, let's say, pleasurable Western NDEs, they would just go on and say, "Ah, no, come on, that's not related to dying. When you want to know what people experience when they really die, you have to read the Tibetan Book of the Dead."
Right. And this is the ultimate authority. This is 2,000 years old, 5,000 years old, whatever they say, right?
Yeah, and this is what really people said to me. I said, "No, look, guys, I have some good literature about near-death experiences. Why don't you just go and read that?" And said, no, because, you know, Mazambhava has written that 2,000 years ago and things like that. And so I felt compelled to, let's say, clear things up and to compile or to show for first time, it seems, how the Tibetan Book of the Dead was developed in a very, very specific Tibetan spiritual tradition over the course of many, many centuries by different individuals who are in part even known as a person. It's not that some 2,000 or whatever years ago, some god appeared and said, "Now write this down and this is what happens and now go and meditate and you can verify it in a scientific way." That's just not what it is. And even in Tibet, in the different traditions that exist and existed there, you find many different approaches to describe what happens to a person dying. And so, yeah, and there are even contradictions too. Current NDE research to other cultures, concepts of what happens to people when they die. So I think we really need to put that document in the proper context. And this is what I tried to do.
Right. And I think you do very nicely and very convincingly. And as you just outlined, I see you kind of pulling apart two problems with how we use the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And the first is, as you just said, there's this history that's completely intertwined with a religious tradition and a cultural tradition that has certain, as we know they do, has certain biases and certain motivations that aren't generally associated with kind of pure science or pure telling of human experience. I mean, it gets into very much kind of spiritual salesmanship to a certain extent, because it can't do otherwise. And it's not putting it down. It's just, hey, that's the way things work. If you look at the history of any religious tradition, it does get into at some point the idea of promoting and perpetuating the tradition because it has to survive. But then the other thing you pull apart is the also complicating factor that as we've absorbed it into the West, we've applied our own filters on it that, oh, this is a psychological text about transformation, or no, it's a very scientific approach to it. It's purely scientific, or even it's a humanistic approach. It's about really about people. It's not even about spirituality so much. So maybe you can speak to both of those. I mean, you kind of have spoken to one, but if there's anything you want to add to how the cultural influences of Tibetan Buddhism and the religious influences might have distorted what we got through the original experiences, and then how we in the West have kind of added this layer of disinformation or misinformation, really, because I don't think they were intentionally trying to misinform people, but how that's been layered on top of it.
Yeah, well, I can talk a little about that, but basically the real person to talk about this would be Brian Cuevas, the one who unearthed all this and who described all this in the book that I mainly draw from in my Tibetan text. He's the one who showed how the psychological, the scientific, and also the humanistic approach was adopted and promoted by Westerners. So I've just recapitulated that part in my paper. But yeah, I think he's true. And we also have to put that book and its earliest translation in English or in Western language into the context of when it appeared. And it appeared much earlier than the book of, let's say, Raymond Moody, who popularized NDE research in the 70s of the last century. So the Tibetan book was much earlier. And so it had a greater impact because the desire of the people to know what's going on when people die was still there. But there were not many sources to consult, except from very obscure parapsychological books and studies or psychical research. But people just, many people don't know about this. And that's excellent work. But anyway, this Tibetan Book of the Dead, it radiated a huge attraction at these times. And so it filled a gap, and it was easy to utilize it for any kind of fashionable concepts and of psychology and of religion and so on. So finally, the Westerners, with their quite limited spirituality at that time, they had the solution. Well, let's look at those old guys. They worked it out. That's how it is. And so it came as a great relief. And I think that's one of the reasons why it became so successful.
Right. So what would be your kind of final, where do you come down at the end of it in terms of how you think we should approach looking at the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and in particular, how we should understand it in light of more contemporary near-death experience science?
Well, I think it is one out of many different ways to describe what happens around the time that people die. But I'm not so sure Westerners can really do much with it. I showed that there are aspects or stages of the dying process that are mirrored by what is known from our recent research, like the out-of-body experience. There's some type of life review. There are some other similarities apart from also the differences that they exist. So it shows there's a common base, a common foundation and all that. But with regard to all the specialities and the specifics that this book contains, I think we can look at it in two ways. First, from a purely cultural perspective, from a cultural context, to see how it developed and also what people of a specific context experience when they meditate. And the other thing is that I think we perhaps have an opportunity to get a glimpse of the factors that shape actual near-death experiences, if we would be able to document near-death experiences, for example, from advanced Tibetan lamas or gurus who have experienced tremendous amounts of stress and life danger threatening and all kinds of danger when they had to escape from the Chinese oppression. So maybe we could find people who suffered NDEs from the Tibetan context and who were all knowledgeable in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I'd be really interested in what they report from their spontaneous near-death experiences. Would that match the description of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, or would that rather match the typical near-death experience as it is described in the Tibetan Delok accounts or in other traditional cultures of Asia and Southeast Asia, which are known and which are known to differ in certain respects from the Tibetan Book of the Dead? So if advanced lamas with the practice of meditation in the context of the Tibetan Book of the Dead would experience precisely what is written in that book, I think that would have a certain impact on our understanding of NDEs and other factors that shape NDEs and how even your personal attitudes and your personal training could shape what you experience during an NDE or, I don't know, perhaps even in an afterlife. So that's an interesting topic I'd like to know more about, but if at all, it certainly will be very difficult to retrieve reports of such persons.
Well, you know, and as you're saying that, I was thinking, you know, that gets to the larger question of where can we really go with near-death experience research, if you will, or science. And it seems to me that we have this huge wall, and it's kind of the evidential wall is we've leaped over it, even though there's a lot of people that don't want to leap over it with us. You know, it's like, hey, this is real. This happens. This seems to completely undermine this dorky idea we've had of how the mind is wholly a product of the brain. That seems to be cast aside by this research. But I'm just not sure what we can do beyond that. You know, and I remember interviewing Raymond Moody, who can be sometimes very difficult to listen to. He kind of talks in rhymes and sometimes has some kind of weird associations that he makes. But one thing he kind of was really insistent on, and it just kind of stuck with me, and I don't know if it's true or not, but he said that, you know, really when it comes to NDEs, we need a completely different system of logic. And I would extend that and say a system of language before we can ever really talk about this stuff scientifically. So I wonder if this whole field just brings us up to the point of saying, okay, something very strange is going on. But then I'm always a little leery when we extend beyond that and say, oh, well, okay, this is a completely new realm that we've discovered, but we can use all our same tools. We can just pack them on our back and bring them with us as we investigate this. I don't know that we can.
Well, I think we can, of course, go there and use our methods that we use in other science disciplines. For one, I always would prefer an experimental approach, like out-of-body experiences. Why not try to investigate them experimentally, like Charles Todd has, for example, done it, or some other people earlier?
Great. I'm with you on all that, Michael. But the end result of all those experiments is just that this is real. This really happens. I don't know how, because as soon as we get past that, we have all these, you know, how many angels fit on the head of a pin questions, right? So you can use traditional science, materialistic science, and you can use it really well to say whether or not this is observable inside of our shared conscious experience that we have. But once you get beyond that, is it really possible to say much that is at all meaningful beyond that?
To a certain degree, yes, because I think what science does and should do is collect evidence that, or in the best cases, proof. Of course, that's difficult. And I, for my part, I always have the feeling there's a very large imbalance, especially in frontier areas of science, between what we can observe and what people expect to make out of these observations. Like, They sometimes go, okay, yeah. Perhaps you out of body experiences, veridical observations from out of body experiences. Perhaps they are real, but we don't have a theory, so it can't be real. So they put too much emphasis on having a theory or not having a theory. But for me, that's not the right approach. And so I think if we have the facts, and I think we have already quite good facts, we can go on to moving about thinking what does that all mean, but we should not expect to come up with a sound and waterproof theory or perhaps with explanations and predictions. What can you make out of that and all that? I think it would be nice if it would be the case, but I always have the impression that reality or even consciousness is larger than what I can penetrate with my human logic. And I think if you go into the realm of quantum physics or even in the theories of relativity and all the physicians trying to get together and find a theory of everything, and I don't think that they will succeed, because I think that we will not be able to penetrate the foundations of nature, the foundations of existence, with bottom-up causality and logic. I think that's begging too much of nature. And when we talk about frontier areas of science and near-death experiences, I also don't think that our logic will help us to fully understand that. But it's enough to understand the basics. And
right.
That's, yeah, even without having a sound theory, about how does dualism work? How does the mind and the brain interact? I don't know if we will ever understand that fully, but that doesn't mean that I reject it because the theory is lacking, as some people seem to do.
Yeah, I always think of the famous quote from quantum physicist Richard Feynman, who said that anyone who claims that they understand quantum physics is either a fool or a liar. And I think you could, you might say the same thing with extended consciousness and near-death experience research, you know. But I agree with you completely that I think the process of tiptoeing up to the chasm is where a tremendous amount of growth can come in terms of expanding our understanding of who we are and how we might fit in. So we don't have to have all the answers to kind of make a difference. I can say that personally. I think the data that so many brave researchers like you and others have brought forward has really been transformational, because I think it gives us a different worldview that does allow us to kind of see the world differently. So what else should we talk about?
Well, one thing I might add is that the interest in terminal lucidity is, in fact, growing, which is great. And I just like to add that there is one study in particular, which is conducted by Professor Batiani in Vienna at the University of Vienna. He's at present conducting what he calls European Terminal Lucidity Study. And he's aiming at sending out questionnaires to many thousands of practitioners in the health business hospital scene, specifically asking for reports of terminal lucidity. And I know he's doing quite well, and he's received some very interesting feedback and reports, especially again out of the Alzheimer's context. So that's good to see. I think he will really do his part in promoting the need to perform research into that business. And also in Switzerland, there is a study that is at present performed into end-of-life experiences, including terminal lucidity. And I think there is a growing awareness regarding that topic, and that's good to see. That's why I write these things, and I'm glad if people pick it up and take up their own initiatives and go on and start to investigate that thing. And I think I'm looking into the future with an optimistical perspective, so that in, let's say, 10, 20 years, maybe we'll know much more about than what we know today.
Dr. Nam, you've been at the forefront of doing a lot of this work in near-death experience science. What are you up to lately? What are you doing now, and what can we expect to see from you in the future?
Oh, wow, that's always difficult to predict, but at present, I'm compiling material on the question in how far hydrocephalic people or generally people with a very reduced or unusual brain mass in their heads can behave normally. That focuses on the work of John Lorber. You may have heard of him, who performed this large series of hydrocephalic patients, and he found that a limited number of them, although they seem to have greatly reduced brain volumes and brain tissue, brain structures that differed greatly from the typical and usual brain structures, still performed very good and even had IQs of far above 100. So that's, I'm trying to elaborate more aspects of potential discrepancies of brain structure, brain functioning, and the intelligence associated with these misconstructed brains, so to say. So that's one of my present occupations.
Great, great. And again, if folks want to check out your website, we'll link it up, but it's michaelnam.com. And it's just spelled. We'll have the spelling. I'm not going to spell it for people over the air. That's always a little bit annoying. But it's great work. It's very interesting work. It's been great having you on. Thanks again so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks again for inviting me.
Thanks again to Michael Nam for joining me today on Skeptico.
One question I tee up from this interview came at the end when Dr. Nam and I talked about the limits of collecting more data, if you will, about near-death experience and related accounts. Does the data get us anywhere once we've established that there's a reality to this phenomena? Can we do much more with our basically materialistic-based scientific tools of investigation when we're talking about this realm of extended consciousness? I think he had a great answer, by the way, but I still want to throw that out there for all of you to discuss with me, and maybe Dr. Nam if he joins us in the forum. So to get to the Skeptico forum or to leave a message on the Skeptico website, go to skeptico.com at skeptiko.com. There you can find links to all of our previous shows, over 275 of them, available for free download from there on the site or through iTunes. You can get most of them, but you can get all of them from the website for free, MP3 downloads. We're also uploading more and more of them on YouTube and hope to get them all up there as well. I have some really good shows coming up, including a couple of pretty hardcore near-death experience debates, one with University of British Columbia professor Evan Thompson, and one with award-winning science writer John Hogan. I like both of those guys a lot, but I did enjoy kind of hammering out some NDE science issues with them. Those are coming up in the next few weeks. There'll also be some other really good interviews thrown in there as well. Those are just the two that come to top of mind as I'm speaking here, but I have some other really good shows as well that you'll see in the coming weeks. So do stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.